Welcome, folks, to episode 3826 of the Survival Podcast, and I'm excited today because we have a special guest who many of y'all hear from frequently because he's a member of our expert council. That is Kerry Brown from Strong Roots Resources, and we're going to talk about what happens when you thought, I'm going to build this really great homestead, I'm going to have all the things, I'm going to do all the things, I'm going to get all the animals, I'm going to have a garden, it's going to produce food for me, I'm going to be all kinds of self-sufficient and self-reliant. And then one day you wake up and go, all I do is work. This thing owns me now. It's gone into chaos mode. I'm putting more work in than I want to. Maybe it's not even you're putting more work in than results you get out, but like it just all seems like it's tedious. You really want a better design. You want a system that actually works. That's what Kerry's going to talk to us about today and more. How do you actually use smart design so that your homestead is an asset instead of an anchor? In fact, Kerry should probably take that and make that a marketing slogan right there. Make your homestead into an asset instead of an anchor. And this is something I struggle with myself, too, like especially every time we travel. It's not that big of a deal as long as we're here. But, you know, sometimes I like to go places, and then I'm not here, and then I need somebody that knows how to work all the stuff. And, you know, the more I design well, the more I automate, the more I can step away. That's one of my goals. Whatever your goals are, those need to be considered in your design decisions as you build out your homestead. So we'll be talking about all of that more with Kerry in just a minute. Before we do, let's go ahead and talk about our two sponsors of the day today. Sponsor of the day number one today is Above Phone. With Above Phone, you can rise above with the best privacy phones, laptops, and tablets on the market. It will stop the problem you have that maybe you don't know you have, or maybe you're aware of it and you don't think there's anything you can do about it, and that is spying. Yeah, I know you don't think you're that important, but big data companies do, so and so does the government. So you have your device manufacturer spying on you and collecting your data, even when they say they're not. You have your carrier doing it, and every single one of those little apps you install into that phone pewter, thank you, Liberty Mutual, for that idea, for that phone pewter, is another thing, a little piece of software that does something neat for you, but it also spies on you and collects your data. What if you could make it all go away, get even better performance, and keep your privacy? What if even when you wanted to use one of those apps or little pieces of software on your phone computer, you could still do it, but it only could do the things that it does that you don't like when you're willing for it to do it because it's only when you're using it? That's called jail on an Above phone, and you can put those apps into that jail. Check them out. They give you $75 off any phone at Above phone, and if you're like, I bet I can't figure this out. First of all, it ain't that much different. But second of all, they will give you an Above expert. When you get your new device, it will give you a one-hour custom onboarding phone call so that you're able to use your new device just like you're using your old device. Check them out today at abovephone.com. Next, though, today is Canine Academy from Joel Riles. Joel is a personal friend of the Spirico family. In fact, we even got our dog, Belle, from him. During a drunken barter blanket, to be honest, but my wife did all of that and made a bunch of promises that I had to keep, like consulting for Joel's business and having him in my home for a week, which was fun. And he came out, delivered our dog, and gave us some initial training. But maybe you don't have the time, the money, the resources to have a Joel Riles come to your house and spend a week with you. Well, what if you could get all of the information about how to train your dog from someone like Joel without leaving the comfort of your home? You can do that at Canine Academy, where instead of training dogs, Joel trains people to train dogs. And you can take the problem-solving library for free to get a feel of what it's like. Lots of courses there. You can pick and choose whatever works best for you. With that, we are wrapped up with our housekeeping. I want to bring our special guest on, Kerry Brown from Strong Roots Resources.
Howdy.
Okay, you are speaking. Anyway, oh, you froze. Okay. Real quick, I forgot to do this during the intro. I'm gonna leave you here, but I'm also gonna do this real quick. I got this book last night, and it's a fantastic book. I didn't obviously get to read it yet, but I have kind of gone through it. It's called From the Badge to the Vine: A Journey Through Duty, Trauma, and Healing. Our podcast is actually mentioned in here for just a real brief moment. This is by K.L. Sadler, who was as a retired special agent, worked for the FBI, went through a lot of things. This is a very inspirational book. She wrote a really great handwritten letter along with it. I just wanted to push that out for her today and let you guys know about it. She's one of us, been with us for like since 2012. She actually used the online church I created as a religious exemption objection to COVID. Again, the book is called From the Badge to the Vine, A Journey Through Duty, Trauma, and Healing by K.L. Sadler. There's a link in today's show notes if you want to take a look at that book. Sorry about that, Carrie. I almost forgot, but glad to have you with us, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Hey, for people that maybe are new to the show, maybe they haven't caught an expert panel with you on it yet, or maybe they caught one or two, but it's just expert panel segments. Can you give me a little about your background? How did you get into what you're doing today with Strong Roots? What do you do? And what brought you to it?
So, yeah, it's been a little bit of a roundabout path, as it seems to be for a lot of us. I am a Knoxville, Tennessee native. I am actually the fourth generation here on our family farm that my great-grandfather purchased in the 30s. And so my upbringing was kind of a blend of farm kid, but also suburbia, because while we have this, you know, beautiful green space here in West Knox County, as I grew up, suburbia very much developed around us. So most of my friends actually lived just down the road in a subdivision. So my time would be spent either reading books in trees or being a plant nerd even then, or maybe riding bikes in the neighborhood and playing video games. So very much that kind of older millennial, younger Gen X era. Did the whole public school thing, was very unimpressed with it, felt very early on that perhaps the system was a scam. And so I was in a hurry to get that over with. But at the same time, I was also heavily influenced by mostly by my grandmother to go to college and get the good job. And my initial plan was to be a communications major. And I did 1 year at East Tennessee State University. And while I was there, my freshman year, 9/11 happened, and it changed my course. Initially, it was kind of ironic. I heard that classes were canceled, that something had happened in New York, but I hadn't really turned the TV on.
Oh.
And needed to make a run to Walmart. And so I went down to the Walmart, and quite literally, looks like something out of a 90s action movie. The guns are flying off the shelves and the ammo is flying off the shelves. And I'm in rural Northeast Tennessee and I'm like, this is a little bit bonkers. So, about that time, you could say that I kind of started to fall down the prepper rabbit hole and kind of incorporated that into my way of life. So ultimately decided that, more university was not a good fit for me. I was very impatient with the whole process. So I came back home, kind of, tinkered around for a couple of years with just jobs and just trying to save a little money and figure out what my next path was. And following the whole 9/11 thing, I became interested in public service. And by 2004, I had gotten my EMT license and I began working for the local private ambulance service. And I did that for 15 years. Until, that would be October of 2019, finally hit my last epic round of burnout on that whole mission and just walked away from it. Had a couple of just regular wage jobs lined up to just kind of sustain us while I figured out what I wanted to be doing. And one of those wage jobs was working for a family bakery. They were, kind of part of my friend group. Their family owned a bakery, and it was an incredibly low stress job that actually paid about the same as what I'd been making when I left the ambulance. And so, we were kind of rocking and rolling through the end of 2019, got through the busy season and everything, through the holidays. March 2020 rolls around and the world gets sideways yet again. And, they had to close the bakery. It ended up being temporary, but we didn't know that at the time. So all of us get laid off, mostly because there were the safety concerns at the time, but also just people stopped coming into the shop. People were afraid to get out. This was not a big operation with a lot of big margins. So all of a sudden I'm back at the house, at this time at a little urban homestead in the city that my wife and I had. And kind of sitting there going, well, I guess this is my opportunity to really launch what I want to do. So Strong Roots kind of officially started as just like property maintenance, mowing, just planting things. And as it happens, when you keep showing up and keep doing a good job, people ask you, well, what else do you do? What are you really into? And I'm like, well, I really like this permaculture thing and systems thinking, and I could create an entire foodscape for your yard. And so some people started to take me up on that offer, and I've just kept after it. And I've basically scaled the business. I'm still very, very happy to do urban and suburban size projects. I think you can get very, very creative with those smaller sites. But at this point, I will visit and consult and advise people, you know, on up to any, you know, a large acreage family farm, because as we know, the principles are the same.
They absolutely are. Can you kind of talk about maybe why so many people burn out on homesteading or prepping? I mean, I don't think anybody actually built a channel up. There's almost a whole genre of former homesteaders on YouTube. Like, I got chickens and they sucked and I got rid of them and the garden was full of weeds and I just pulled everything out and I went back to my life. And, you know, most people that get into this are probably not going to do that, but everybody has that thought once in a while. Because you start to realize, like, okay, I have to all this stuff I have to do now. And the reason I did it in the first place is I wanted my life to be easier, not give myself more work.
Yeah, and I think it's important to address up front that there's a little bit of, maybe more than a little bit, but there is some misleading content about the quote-unquote simple life and minimalism and that kind of stuff. At this stage, being on the farm now, I have more stuff and more complexity in my life than I ever have. Going to a job and tinkering with my gardens and chickens at the urban homestead and what I'm doing now, two totally different lives. So I think a solid dose of reality from the get-go is important. And I also really encourage people, like when I go out for a consult or if I'm just having a conversation with somebody, to really examine your own motivations for doing this. I started doing it because I became I wasn't doing it out of a sense of fear, maybe a little bit initially, but I kind of got over that. I simply loved the concept of working my way around system, like working outside of control systems. That was just always kind of my baseline thing. And so I really try to help people drill down early on in the thinking process of, why do you want to do this? And what do you feel like it's going to bring to you? And so we'll have entire conversations, you know, over the phone or through email before I even show up to a property a lot of the time. And if people are, if they're operating out of a fear mindset or a fear motivation, I try to catch that early and address that. Sometimes I feel like I'm more of a counselor than a consultant. But if they can't move past that, I generally just kind of wish them well and say, I don't think I'm gonna be a good fit for you. So even as crazy as the world is right now, I'm not really scared of anything. And I don't think people should be. I think fear is a form of control. So I like to address that outright. And then secondly, in the more practical sense, is it's kind of basic, but get really good at one thing first. So I got really good, reasonably good, at managing a coop and run system for the chickens, both at the place in the city and then what we're doing now, and discovered that the best way for me to run chickens is like in a deep bed, kind of compost operation, mm-hmm. Not birds running around everywhere, wrecking my gardens, birds getting picked off by hawks and owls and everything that's out here, but birds in a very safe system where they can do their job, get all the nutrient they need, but be safe. And I don't really have to think about it beyond some food, bringing them garden weeds and mixing up, you know, hauling out, mixing up the finished compost out of the system.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't have to put them to bed. They're already there. You don't have to move a chicken tractor every day. You don't have to come out and there's a chicken doing this and there's cluds of dirt coming out of your garden bed. Or you learn like I did last year that chickens think Sweet Alyssum is candy. Right. Like, I never had anything touch Sweet Alyssum until last year and chickens found it. And then it was like they passed the word. You know, so having that kind of contained system Everybody wants, everybody thinks they want free range. Everybody thinks they want all the things. And sometimes you need to look at it. And from what I hear you saying here, more like, but what is the thing that I need for me in my situation, in my context at this time, at this point in my life, and based on what I want to be able to do next month?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big part of it. I feel like some people get a little bit attached to a concept or an ideology or something that they read, which is completely irrelevant to their specific land situation or their region. Like the whole free range bird thing, that is not a good idea in a lot of cases. I think Joel Salatin says, if you want free range chickens, so like the way they run them at Polyface is that they're in electric netting. They've got that big structure they can get under. But the key to that system working for them is that there's like 500 birds. And so according to what Joel and the crews out there have been able to study is that if there is a hawk or some kind of bird of prey up in the air, that doesn't look like a bunch of individual birds. It looks like one massive animal. That's how it's perceived. So for those of us who are running 8 to 10 or maybe even 50 birds, that's just a lot of tasty snacks just out there to be consumed.
Mm. Gotcha. How do you design systems so that they're scalable instead of overwhelming? Because I think one of the big things is trying to do too much at once. But the other thing is if you can get a person to understand scale, they're going to be more likely to like completely dial in, let's say, the chicken system and then put in the garden. And after completely dial in the garden system, like how do we keep people in that mindset of like, let's anchor down on the one thing you said you really wanted first. Let's get it working so you're not trying to fix it while you're trying to build. And you don't get overwhelmed.
Yeah, exactly. So a couple of different things here. So one is I try to think a problem through to a sense of completion. So because it's real easy to get this good enough for now mindset. But kind of I like to pair things through really frugal means, especially like when I was making, you know, $8, $10, $11 an hour, frugality was everything to us. So I would create a system, since we're talking about the chickens here. I knew like the main thing for the birds where we were at was that they would be safe, not so much from hawks in that case, but raccoons and things trying to get in. That was our issue. Raccoons and gigantic rats were the issue in the city. So I didn't need an incredibly expensive coop system. I had a dog glue that no dog was using anymore, fitted a door to it, made a good clasp and all that good stuff. And that's what those first four birds I had, that's what they went into. And, you know, used what I had on hand that was effective but inexpensive, observed, you know, the issues that arose and adjusted from there. So I'm a big fan of trying not to sink a bunch of money into something early on. And then eventually we scaled to a more like kind of standard coop and then, you know, enclosed the run, you know, expanded the run and, used a lot of overhead, trees overhead to kind of act as, shade and shield and everything. So, this is kind of where the concept of function stacking can really, benefit. So, even for a while here at our, where we've been here for 6 years now, I have my rabbit system separate. I had the rabbits on the shady side of a shop and the chickens were a little bit further up the hill. So it was, you know, paths that I was walking during, you know, daily chores and everything. And then I realized there's nothing stopping me from parking this rabbit hutch right next to the chickens and putting another set of kennels on the inside. So I have kind of a rotation where, the females that are awaiting to give birth are in a super safe hutch system on the outside, but right next to the birds. And then the males and anybody who's not being bred are in more of like, they're basically dog kennels that are up off the ground. And so everything is just right there. It's right there in one place. Rabbit droppings are falling to the ground. Apparently chickens love rabbit droppings. They are making compost with that. They're eating a lot of the same stuff. So I bring, you know, garden weeds and things to the birds and to the rabbits. And, when it's time to kind of change out who's being bred and who's, you know, making, giving birth and all that, we just kind of rotate and they're all right there. right there in one location. And, I mean, that's a pretty simple concept. It's, you know, this is not something we have to overly complicate, but it works really well. And it works, you know, it's easy for me. And then when I'm traveling, it's easy for my wife. And there's no need to be zipping all over, even a zone one, trying to get all these tasks knocked out.
So let's talk about the difference then between busy and productive. Because I think that's a big problem for a lot of people, that they feel like, hey, man, one of the reasons they feel frustrated is because they feel like all I do is work. But sometimes maybe it's physical work, but it's not productive work. And so the person feels exhausted, and then they look and everything's just not what they wanted it to be. How do we dial that in so the things that we're doing are actually benefiting us?
Yeah, I kind of see busy as just a whole bunch of short-term tasks where you're just trying to keep the system from falling apart. You're patching repairs. You know, you're dealing with an escaped animal because you haven't tightened up a particular system, and you just feel like you're treading water, and it's exhausting, and it's no fun. I see productive as like I'm actually seeing value being built off of my energy and the inputs. So this is one of those times where I like to take people back to appropriate zoning, like permaculture zoning. Plenty of times I will see people be on a big piece of land or buy a big piece of land, and they immediately feel like they got to stretch everything out over the whole whatever 10 acres. And we know we don't need to do that. There's nothing wrong with having having things real close to your house so that it's a tight and efficient system. Because our property is really hilly, and when we were – because we kind of developed – where we're living here on the farm now, we developed all that from scratch. There was nothing out here, no real infrastructure. We did, you know, brought the cabin and the shop and everything and the high tunnel and all that as we went. And we also don't have a lot of flat space up here. So I reserved the flat space, relatively flat space, at the highest point on our parcel for it is the drop point for any material that has to be moved anywhere else. If it's firewood, if it's wood chips, compost, straw, anything like that, it goes to that point, which is also just off of the driveway, so that any heavy or finished compost material, anything like that, all that's moving downhill. Everywhere it needs to go is downhill from there. A lot of the time I'm actually moving, I move a lot of stuff still with wheelbarrow, broad fork, things of that nature. I don't, I can thank the Tactical Redneck for giving me a four wheeler last year. That's been a game changer for the sheep big time, but, there's still a lot of stuff that is just moved, you know, just one shovel full at a time. And so, that seems like a super simple and like, duh, system, but when I first got established here, my compost was down the hill, not a great distance, but I realized in most cases anywhere that finished material needed to come back uphill, and that kind of got old. So I kind of like to earmark out what makes sense from a point of workflow for use gravity to your advantage. I realized early on that I didn't need to worry so much about making things look pretty, although it is important to me that there's not, I don't want it to look, you know, junky or messy. But a lot of people are like, I don't want a big pile of wood chips in my front yard. My wood chips are basically in my front yard. When people come up here, I tell them, park by the wood chip pile. That's fine. That's where stuff collects. But it's just made a world of difference than some other hidden away placement. We try to hide things that we consider unsightly.
Gotcha, man. So how can someone on a small suburban lot apply these same principles? I think one advantage they have is they're going to be a hell of a lot less likely to end up all over the place, because that's what happens when the first big property you get when you have this bug, the first thing you want to do is the biggest thing that's the furthest away from your house, which is exactly what not to do. So at least they have that going for them. But I think a lot of times they think, well, I can't really do that much. I need, you know, 5, 10, 20 acres or something like that. And no, you don't. And put it bluntly, fully utilized, a 1 acre will wear your ass out.
Yes, it will.
And you could do a lot with a half acre, third acre lot too. So how do they apply this mindset?
So when I come in on one of these, we still go ahead and we identify the zones. Even if all you've really got is, say, zones, you know, 1 through 3, I feel like they can be, the zones can kind of be squeezed, you know. So your zone 1 might only be a, you know, I don't know, maybe a 50 by 50 footprint, but, and zone 2 is a little further out, but it's kind of like compressed down. And I actually played with this experiment when we were, so the urban homestead we had, we developed that over 14 years. So that was what I did when I was off duty. That was my hobby. That was my passion, probably my obsession. And so I was always in the back of my mind planning, how can I get more production and more efficiency out of this space? So this, for reference, this was a 1/5 acre urban lot, 50 by 100 feet, with a 950 square foot house sitting on that. And I found this was probably one of my weird obsessions and hobbies, was to kind of discover these little underutilized nooks and strange little corners and things. And like, what can I be doing here? How can I put this to work? And even after 14 years, I still don't feel like I had fully maxed it out. Like there was still stuff I was kind of planning to do before we decided we were ready to get out of the city. One example was, I didn't like areas to serve only one function. So this kind of drove my wife nuts until she kind of caught on to what I was doing. But we had a little 10 by 10 deck, and eventually we covered it and screened it in, south facing. And all we had out there were a couple of hammocks. And there was this whole strip at the end, maybe a 2 foot wide and then 10 foot long strip at the southmost end. And I said, this is a great place to have my seed starts going, because I didn't really have a spot where I could just lay out, like do everything on a table and have grow lights and everything. And so, I don't know, maybe around 2016, 2017, somewhere around in there, my wife actually built in these tables with little overhead LED lights. And I think I was able to do like 12 trays or something like that, 12 of the 6-pack trays. And that was plenty to start all of my seeds for the garden, and even enough to share with neighbors. So I feel like there is just underutilized space everywhere. One more good example here that I liked, we had this kind of, see, though, this would have been a northeast facing corner, so pretty much always shaded. Of course, nothing's really going to grow there. Stayed kind of cool, stayed kind of damp. And when we redid our bathroom, we pulled out the old clawfoot tub, and I had the two guys help me place it in that spot, and that became my earthworm system. And it worked great. And so all I really did was, give it a, like, put a plywood cover over it to keep it cooler and keep it from, you know, getting too soggy, and threw in wood chips. And I just kind of had like this continuous, earthworm composting system that worked great, and because it was a cool spot, shady spot, and that's what they needed. So I really encourage people to take a look at, you know, like pull up any permaculture zone graphic online and think about, like, it's often shown as like these circles, like circle within a circle within a circle. It can be any shape. It does not have to be equally.
I hate that, by the way, when you see people teaching permaculture zones and everything's like this uniform bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if they adapt it to the shape of the lot, it's like a series of squares. Like, it absolutely never, ever, ever, never, ever, infinity, ever works out that way.
Yeah. Yeah, if I were to think about the one I had out there now, it would be this, it would look like an amoeba or some shit.
Yeah.
Like, it was just wild, but that's, and I actually ended up establishing a quote-unquote zone 5. We had this kind of corner past the chickens that back to an alley, and I left it alone because I noticed how many there were birds nesting back there. You know, it was just this nice little dense area. And I was like, somebody, I might not be able to see who's using that, but some kind of critter's using that, and I'm going to let it be.
Gotcha. Yeah, mine kind of looks like a giant penis. My son looks. So it's like around the house, and then it's like this peninsula that goes out to let the birds out every day. And
I can see that.
Why would I put it that way? Well, had I built every bit of my infrastructure, I may not have. But since there was this perfect building to be a coop already here when I got here with fence infrastructure and everything in, I was like, I'm not changing that. Why would I change that? If I change that, and then I bear all this expense, what am I going to do? Hire somebody to move a 12 by 16 foot building?
Mm-hmm.
Like, or can I use a walk every morning? Yeah, I can use a walk every morning. Right. So that's not a big deal. Now, if I had 40 acres and it was on the back side of the land, that would have been different. But in a smaller piece of property, 3 acres is what I have. It's just not that big a deal.
Yeah. There's, when I've seen cases of like existing infrastructure where somebody has moved in, you know, if it doesn't make sense to work the way they want to operate things, you know, I'll let them know, like, there's, don't fight with something just because it's there. Yeah. That doesn't mean that the previous people made a good choice, but if you can't adapt it, then adapt it. Same for, like, it kind of fits in with understanding your microclimates, you know, buildings will create microclimates as well. So, maybe that building is not good for whatever task, but the area around it being shaded by it, or the area that's absorbing a lot of sunlight, might be.
Yeah, yeah. Down here, it's really important. Our summers are, yours brutal. Ours are like ultra brutal, right? Mm-hmm. Hobbits come here to throw rings to get rid of them in my backyard. That's how hot it gets. And so, like, I have this shop building, and on the east side of that shop building is where I put my primary garden. And I do that because I get all the sun I need. But by the hottest part of the day, especially like midsummer, when the sun doesn't go down till 9 o'clock, you know, it actually gets hotter between 7:30 and 8:30 here, as crazy as that sounds. And so by that time, that whole garden is shaded. Everything's in recovery. I can run the drip irrigation at that point. Everything's happy. It wakes up all happy in the morning and ready to deal with it again. If I put that in where most people would, like, super sunny area, it just gets baked. Like, it, the solar exposure we have exceeds what the plants can use, and then you go into transpiration and eventually death. You sweat to death, right? They can't deal with it. And then they can't also take up, there's like the calcium's there, but you have, you know, days with temperatures sustained over 100 degrees for long enough, they lose that ability. And by giving them that break, they can recover.
Yeah, that's an important point. And there's a lot of focus on, I want to make sure my plants have enough sunlight. Like, that's always like, do I have my 8 hours or whatever? And even here, I've noticed the same thing, like that late day sun, because we're at about almost 1,100 feet here at our elevation, and not really any shade from anything facing the west, which, and in some cases I can't really add any because solar panels. So, like, when I designed my kind of combo pollinator medicinal garden that's up above the cabin, the western edge has, like, Rose of Sharon and mulberry and some elderberry and a few other things that cast shade late day onto a lot of the other more tender plants. And because we're kind of going back to, like, your observe and interact phase of your principles. Cannot stress the importance of that. And we were kind of, because we had a bit of a holding pattern when we initially got out here, we prepped the site for the cabin. We came here in October, but the cabin did not arrive until April. So I was staying in our workshop, sometimes at mom and dad's when it was way too cold. And so I had at least like fall through winter to be thinking about all of that before I started plugging in a bunch of garden systems up here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to, before we move on, just to reinforce, Carrie and I are talking about two different geographies, a very similar problem. Mine is probably more than his, but you have the same issue. But the further you move north, or your property may just be different, microclimates, et cetera, you may not want to take the approach we do. Like, when I had my house in Pennsylvania, my wife planted all these, we had this really nice, like, landscape, like conventional suburban landscaping looking island in front of the house, you know, wood chip, mulch, weed blocker, all that. And she went to Home Depot or Lowe's or wherever and bought like 4 flats of marigolds, planted them in the spring after we got past frost. And it was beautiful, gorgeous marigold field, basically. And there was like this one little bit of marigolds they were healthy. They were just a lot smaller than everybody else. And it was just a spot where the roof of the house cast shade for about 1 hour earlier than the rest of it went into shade. And so in that environment, you would have wanted almost full sun all day long. Totally different environment. So just because we say a thing doesn't mean it directly applies to you. You always have to go into the context of where you are, what your climate is, what your zone maps are, all of that stuff. Just so nobody goes and says, hey, I need to put everything in shade, because if you're in Vermont, you probably don't. What are some early warning signs, though, that your system design is unsustainable? I kind of look at this like cancer screening. Like, cancer sucks. But you would be much better off finding like a 1 millimeter mass that's, you know, isolated to one place before it spreads. I find that homestead chaos spreads like cancer, right? Yeah. And so if we can catch that we're making a mistake early and we don't double down, triple down, quadruple down on the same mistake, we could stop it early.
Yeah. So this, for me, I've noticed, if it makes me mad, which is relatively easy to do anyhow, I've never been overcome with patience, but if it's just one of those things where it's like, I am constantly fighting with a latch that doesn't want to line up, or, you know, I notice that if there's like one particular, sheep that just keeps poking that head under the fence and ignoring the fact that the fence is most definitely on. And I have confirmed that, you know, I just try really hard not to ignore the little things, like you said, so that they don't compound, because what will happen inevitably, like Murphy's Law, all of that stuff will go wrong on one day. And it's usually like a day that I'm maybe not even here and it happens on Angel's Watch or something. So, address the little stuff early. I know it's hard because we're very, you know, a lot of us are just, I can be very ADD, feel like I'm being pulled a million different directions. My phone's blowing up with all kinds of stuff. But I really do try to fix the small issues first. And then I'm kept in check to an extent by my wife, because she has, she's an amazing woman, but she's got a little bit of mobility issue. So, and she's a few years older than me. So I'm already thinking about how is this going to work, you know, as she ages, and it's hard for her to manipulate certain fine motor tasks and that sort of thing. And, you know, and I'm, you know, a walking, ball of soreness most of the time anyhow. So if it's frustrating for me, I know it's got to be worse for her. So trying to address stuff like that. And, you know, if you're constantly annoyed with these tasks, there's either a couple of things going on. Either, you know, you need to tune something up, or maybe you just don't want to be doing it. And that's okay too. Like, I kept some quail for a while at the city, and I kept telling myself once we were back out here on the farm, like, I would get the quail going again, and I just never did it. We built the building and everything, never put a dang animal in there. And it's like, turns out I don't really want to deal with those goofy little birds. And so I ended up converting that building, just a little footprint of a building, but I threw plastic on it. Now it's a greenhouse. And that I definitely use. So don't get hung up on some kind of, on like your own internal narrative. I am willing to upend my way of thinking about things and admit that I'm wrong or in error all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to communicate with Nicole, who joined us here. And I tried to put, because she's telling a story of matching what you're talking about with Tactical Redneck leaving a sheep fence off and left yesterday. And she had to lead them back with one arm because she has that injury to her shoulder. And I just think this is interesting. I tried to put bad redneck into the comments like four times, four different ways. And YouTube has decided I'm spamming my own channel with the word redneck. It is very upset about the word redneck, doesn't want to let it through, so hopefully they won't demonetize us for saying it. But yeah, I completely agree. I think like part of that is like designing for who you'll become rather than who you are. Like sometimes people will ask me, like, do you ever like kind of forget when you're 50? I said, yeah, for about 5 minutes, and then my body will remind me.
Yep.
Right? You know, like, hey, and honestly, I'm going to tell you guys, like, your extended warranty runs out at about 45, right? And no one will renew it. Like, you can get away with so much as a dude up till about 45, and then it's like all that crazy shit you did to yourself from the time you were probably about 10 up until probably you were about 35 and said, hey, I need to stop being done. It all comes back, and it's like, hey, you did this. And, yeah, yep. The back hurts, you're sore, all of it. But, yeah, I think if we could cut that stuff off early, like you said, if it makes you mad, it's probably a problem. I think, like, we all do this. Like, you see this thing, and like I say, it's a pipe, and it's going drip. And you go, and you look at it, and, like, 5 minutes go by, and it doesn't drip, and then it drip. And you're like, ah. No, fix it. You know, even if you're like, okay, I can make it to the weekend, probably. But if you just let it go, you're going to come out and there's going to be a giant puddle and a bunch of ducks making a mud hole and water going everywhere. Like, and I'm not saying that particular thing. Something like that is going to happen.
Yeah. Yep.
So how do livestock fit into, like, a freedom-based lifestyle? Because I find that's probably the thing that anchors us more than anything else is when I get a house sitter – I need somebody to take care of the dogs, which I'm about to go put out the door, so she'll leave me alone. But I also need somebody that can handle, like, ducks. I need somebody that, like, if one of my pumps and one of my systems dies, they know how to swap a pump out, like, because then things die if you don't fix that. How do we balance the benefit of livestock with the way they anchor us to the land?
So my livestock, they must obey the rules. So I'll, you know, the sheep have kind of really become my thing here for a few years now. They are not allowed to engage in any kind of unproductive, problematic, unsafe behavior. So one example, fairly recently, not something I'm thrilled and proud to say that I did, but we had this ewe lamb that was about 4 weeks old. And generally the way it works, because these sheep are run entirely on three strands of polywire.
Okay.
We do not have any, they're all the original, you know, barbed wire fencing, it is mostly gone now. So, you know, they are trained to that. The adults are well trained to that. And so kind of what happens is that the moms kind of teach the babies, like, hey, this thing bites, we don't touch it. But for whatever reason, this one ewe lamb, and normally it's the rams that do this, but this time it was a ewe, she just decided that she didn't care. And so she would go through a gap. She wasn't pushing under, but she just could see a gap and she would just shoot her little body through it. And so I did my usual checks. I made sure everything was working. I made sure the whole thing was, you know, conducting and the ground rod was, you know, soaked the ground around the ground rod and did all that stuff. Even added a couple of extra strands, which I don't like to do because it kind of messes up my whole system. The more strands I'm using on one paddock, the less ahead I can fence. And so, but I thought, let's give it a couple weeks and see if she'll maybe get a really good shock off of it and learn her lesson.
Mm-hmm.
No go. So, you know, one afternoon, you know, I had to send her off to Lamb Heaven.
Yeah,
and a lot of people are like, dang.
Yeah.
But the thing is it once they learn that that rule does not apply to them, of course, one, it can teach the others, and then you just have chaos.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's like Greg Judy says with his sheep. If one jumps the fence, 30-06.
Yeah.
Because like you put them back in, and the next day there's two. Mm-hmm. You put them back in, and the next day there's four. You put them back in, the next day there's seven. And, and he's running 1,000. So, like, that's a bad thing when they start teaching each other. I also tried to put, when you were talking about the sheep thing earlier, TOA 30-06 in the chat, which Google rejected, and it didn't have a problem with 30-06, so I guess it speaks Swahili. It's Swahili for hand me or give me, right? So if you're on Safari and you TOA whatever you want, right? So it didn't like that either. But yeah, I mean, there's a place for, and I call it, like, I guess that would be sheal. You know, we call it veal with a cow. It's like a baby sheep. Okay. You know, maybe it's going in like a turkey in the oven whole. I don't know, but there is a point where an animal becomes a problem, and it is much more useful to cull that animal than to deal with that animal. And we should remember the difference between livestock and a pet, right? This is because I've had roosters, spermie in the leg, they go straight to the tree.
Yeah.
I mean, you spermie once, we're done. We're not having that. I got grandkids here. I'm not having a, you know. an 8-pound rooster with 1.5-inch spurs can hurt a kid pretty bad. And so once you do it, you're out. I don't want your genetics. I don't want you.
Yep. That's a big part of it. And additionally, like these animals, they all of them, they have to serve a function, ideally more than one. So, you know, of course, with the sheep, obviously I'm getting the meat. I'm getting, you know, money off of selling starter flocks or selling wethers. And then, and of course, they're helping me maintain the property, and we're using it to really repair and improve the soil and the plant life around here through appropriate grazing techniques. Things even like pushing and shoving, like if I get in there, like when I use sweet feed to motivate them to follow me to go to a new paddock, and we got to a point where they wanted to jostle me a lot, like they wanted to shove into me and they're trying to get to that bucket. And, you know, I've learned, like, I don't reward bad behavior. So no. I just stand there with that bucket on my shoulder until everybody chills. Then we can get some feed. So it's like, if you wouldn't allow that behavior from a toddler, I don't allow it from something that's got four legs either.
Yeah. Yeah. It can hurt you a lot more, by the way, if it decides to. I mean,
yeah.
A lamb's not that, you know, baby lamb's not that much of a risk or anything, but you get an adult sheep, ornery, they can do some damage. Yeah. How can teaching or community engagement make sustainability more viable long term? I mean, like, you're not going to have, like, everybody listening to this going to become the next Kerry Brown. There's probably not enough business for everybody to be one. But everybody can do something in that realm, especially as you build something really cool. I think you find that people want to be part of it. They want to see it. They want to engage with it.
Yeah, I would not be to this point if it wasn't for the community that I have found, that have found me, that we've been able to connect in various ways. That has been absolutely essential through this whole thing. So there's a lot of stuff I don't like to do around here. I hate dealing with like cutting out brushy stuff. But if I get 5 or 6 of my buddies come up here and help me do it, suddenly it doesn't suck so bad. So that is a little bit of my trick. I actually have some guy friends that, like, they're city boys and they love to run a chainsaw. And so it's their idea of a good time. It motivates me because I'm going to work alongside them and we're going to get a bunch of stuff done. We're going to, you know, amass that kind of the power of the group. But when I go onto a property and I'm meeting with a potential client for the first time, especially if they have, you know, like recently moved here, which is, I'd say probably 75% of the people I find or who find me are transplants. I ask them, hey, are you tapped into any kind of community yet? Like locally, your neighbors, a church, a group that shares interest on homesteading or whatever the case may be. Do you have people who you can communicate with and get some help and have some work days? And if somebody's really put off by that concept and they're like, oh, I don't want anybody up here. I don't want anybody to know I'm here. And I just kind of say, well, then things are going to be harder. Yeah. I mean, at one point, maybe a couple of years ago, I think I put a thread up on Facebook or somewhere where I actually listed off, like, I met this person who told me about this person who I met. And I like this whole kind of lineage thing that happened. That got me from, I've kind of got this business idea and it's kind of brewing in the back of my mind to, like, it's being executed and it is happening and it is my livelihood and it is supporting, you know, my farm and my family. So, don't be a jerk, the wrong kind of jerk about meeting other people. But these days there are just about every county in Tennessee has some kind of quote unquote homestead alliance. Like, if you just throw it up on Telegram or Facebook or wherever, you know, we've got the East Tennessee Homestead Alliance. We've got a full-fledged, huge festival around that now called the Homestead Event. And there are just endless ways. And it's still to find people. And it still amazes me that I meet people and they're like, I had no idea anybody else around here was doing this. And it's like, I know I'm kind of like in my own little niche and you know, I'm very insulated from the outside. But yeah, there are people who don't realize this is a thing, that it is as big of a thing as it's become. So find your people out there. You are not going to pull this off doing it solo. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe if you're Roorman and you've got 47 kids or something, you might be able to, but yeah, find your people out there, and there is enough variety, you know, if you're more of a tree hugging hippie who doesn't want to see animals die, or if you're, you know, big into prepper and gun culture, whatever the case may be, man, the people are out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, like, they don't see it so much as work, especially if you throw them some like barbecue and beer, because they don't do it every day. So that you can make it kind of recreational. If you have something to teach, I don't have problems with charging a little bit of money on like a small scale workshop, like a 1 day, $20, and then feed them $30 worth of food. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's kind of what we do here. We'll do like a 1 day composting workshop, bioreactor, and we'll bring everybody out, and they do a lot of work for it, but you know, they'll pay $25 and I'll put $35-$40 worth of food down their throats while they're here and make sure they all enjoy themselves. And there's a lot of people that like to do things like this, but they are not willing to commit. Maybe they're not even, they can't, but maybe they don't want to commit to the lifestyle long-term. But like you said, you have buddies that enjoy running a chainsaw. You know, when you said that, my first thought was, I know how to run a chainsaw. I got a whole bunch of shit that needs to be done with a chainsaw right now. None of it fits my priority criteria of, if I don't do it, something's going to die, and it has to be done this week, or it has to be done before something else needs to be done. Those are all my top 1, 2, 3A criteria. So it's constantly deferred until I have enough time and I'm not busy with something else. But if there were two dudes coming over to help me do that, we'd probably get four times more than I could do in the same amount of time alone. So you're going to magnify it. It's almost like having a fourth person when you have three working together in something like that. And then it would immediately go to like, I'd have to create a unique category, like a 1QA3 or something like, it's now because we have the opportunity to get it done far more efficiently.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things like that I think that people could start engaging with. And then like yesterday, I don't know if you heard the show yesterday with John and Nicole, but we had somebody ask the question, how do I find people to get it? And I think, you know, one of the ways you find people to get it is attract people that are interested in a thing, not all the things. So if you run a little like workshop get shit done day on your little homestead, and you put out like on Nextdoor and other local media and whatever, hey, we have this thing going on in 3 weeks, we're gonna give it some lead up so people have time, and we're gonna be doing this, and we're gonna be providing food and beer or whatever, everybody that comes is at least someone that gets part of it, and now you're starting to build community and you've become the host. And you know, if you do that, don't charge for that, just throw it out there, and whoever comes will be grateful that they came. Create some kind of RSVP so you can be prepared. You know how many people are coming. But that's a great way to start engaging with community. And no one is going to come help with like a gardening talk or workshop or something that doesn't like gardening altogether. That's not interested at all, right? Like they're going to be people that are people, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know how John Willis always tells the story of like, you'll be 4 hours from home and you'll meet somebody at an event that lives 10 minutes from you. I started posting about our quarterly gatherings, and I think I just posted it up in like a bunch of local groups and then homesteading groups. And I think this was like the broader East Tennessee homesteading group, where this lady saw the post and pulled up the address. She was like, that's right next where we used to live. And so this lady, who actually shares my name, same spelling and everything, she came over to our event and she said, we used to live in the basically McMansion subdivision to the west of us. And just a few months ago, we bought property down the road that was in very likely to become yet another subdivision, but they bought it and they're keeping it as a farm. So I've got another farmer friend, homesteader friend just down the road in the community that I grew up in, taking care of, you know, making sure we don't have yet another development happening where the growth is just out of control. So, that's just beyond effective. I do that too, because, you know, I hold the foraging classes every month. We're doing the farm tours every month now. They're a little bit shorter. They're not like the longer, more drawn out event, but, you know, a couple hours, farm tours, grazing classes, all these different classes. And every single time, there's, you know, somebody, you know, who's, somebody worth adding to my network.
Yeah.
One more person with another skill set that I can exchange with, that I can barter with. And I think that's one of the – a lot of us who are trying to get into homesteading or live off the land or however you want to term it, we are naturally we're introverted. I'm one of those people. It's a job for me to be extroverted. I'm always a little bit tired after I've done an event, but it just keeps paying off. So yeah. I keep doing it.
Yeah. How do we bring frugality into this? Because I see a lot of projects that cost a lot of money. And it makes me think back to my grandfather's homestead, though it was never called that. It was just where they lived. And like as much as it did for us, it was dramatically simple. We had a main garden that was like 10 rows, 4 foot by like 50 foot rows. And then one big row down the bottom that was much wider that would have go all the way across that span. You know, you had those rows were all like, let's say, vertical from the house. And that longer one, that was the corn patch. And that would have about 9 rows of corn in it. And then there was a little herb patch down from there. That was the garden. And then we had a bunch of like blackberry and stuff like that. We dug up on the mountain and we just buried it on the edge of the property where it transferred to woods. And then in the back of the property, we had four Concord grapevines. They were like 60 years old and they were on this big metal trellis that looked like, I never asked my granddad. Now I wish I would have. I'm pretty sure they went to the junkyard, found metal, stuck it in the ground and welded it together. Right. He didn't weld. So he got a buddy to weld it and he had these vines trained on it and they kind of arced over. And then underneath that arc was a cold frame in the ground that looked like it was made from a big glass door they got from a junkyard. And that way he could do his seed starts and all in the spring there. And then we had a chicken coop and with like 4 chickens and 1 goose in it. Cause the goose was the guard goose and like kind of the victory garden type thing going on with extra grow area on both sides, you know, rotated this year here, that was it. That was the entire thing. There was no money in that. There were no raised beds, right? The cold frame was probably the most complicated thing there, and it was basically a box in the ground with a block and tackle, again, probably salvaged from a junkyard. It didn't look janky. I mean, it all looked nice, and that was it, and it did a lot, and we owned that was probably right around that 1-acre property.
Yeah. My frugal mindset has stuck with me because of the way I was influenced growing up. So, you know, we were raised in a middle class family, but definitely not a family with a whole lot of stored wealth and capital. So, dad worked for himself most of my childhood running his own business. Mom mostly stayed home while we were little and then got some jobs as we were a little bit older. But between like the influence of my parents and especially my grandmother, so my nan, who's, you know, she's been passed away for over 13 years now, which is hard to believe, but she was such an influence, growing up during, you know, she was born during the Depression. And so her parents, they ran their farm in such a way that it was very much like, you know, you reuse everything. There was really not such a thing as a throwaway culture. And so even though she was able to do well, financially later on through a variety of means, she kept that frugal mindset on everything. So, and I just, you know, for the longest time, it was essential for me just because I wasn't making hardly any damn money on that ambulance. And my wife was working at the time too, and we were very much like paycheck to paycheck. And so for me, it was a point of pride to scout around dumpsters, alleyways, behind businesses. I didn't care. I was not ashamed of any of that. And I think maybe that's part of it. I have no shame about picking up stuff off the side of the road. I will still do it today, even though my cash flow is certainly better than it's ever been before. It's just kind of my natural setting. So, we will, we'll collect lumber. We'll recycle metal. If it's not something we can be reused, you know, we'll send it off to be, you know, turned into cash or whatever. I'm just always, always thinking about ways of being frugal. We've got this, chicken coop that it was one of those, it was like kind of cheap and really didn't hold up very well. So we ended up building something better. But we kept most of the coop. We kept the panels with the grating and everything on it. And as we speak, my wife is repurposing that into a little outdoor, basically a little small kennel for the cat. So the cat can be outside on the grass, but the cat be safe because the cat is old. And I mean, just everywhere. I know how to run a sewing machine. I will fix a lot of my own clothes. So that, yeah, between that, you know, the influence of my parents and my grandparents, and the fact that, you know, we've been able to keep this property and this farm secure for so long because nobody got stupid about being so spendy that we accrued debt.
Yeah.
So, and that's just, to me, that's just a very powerful place to be. I can run my bank account a little bit thin if I need to for some reason or another and not really worry that I can't find a way to spin it back up or, you know, convert something around here into some form of value or capital.
Yeah, I think like with frugality, we kind of split in society like a bifurcation. There's two types of people, and it may not be the thing I'm going to give, but it'll be something like it. There is people who, when they were a kid, if they got a hole in their sock where the toe came out of it, their mom or their grandma or somebody darned it, which means, for those who don't know, they sewed it back up so you could keep wearing the sock until it really wore out. If the heel wore out, you threw it away because that shot. And then there's people who didn't, that when a sock got a hole in it, you just threw it away and got a new set of socks or a new package of socks or whatever. Where, you know, if you grew up in my household, you might have worn, you know, your siblings or your cousin's socks until they were completely worn out before they went. And so you either grew up with that mindset, at least on the edges of your life, or you didn't. And now everything is built to break anyway. And so there's so much of this, well, it doesn't work exactly the way it's supposed to anymore. So instead of fixing it or dealing with it, I'll just discard it. And that's both bad and good, because if you're frugal, that means that when that's discarded or sold cheaply, you can benefit from it. And I think there is a big split in that right now. Like, what do you do when a thing breaks? And if your answer is, without any other information, I throw it away and get a new one, you're on the other side of that. And I don't know how long that's going to stay the case, because we have kind of hit an inflection point, I think, here, where we're still living in our heads like it's, you know, 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But we're actually in an economy that's a lot more like 1979 than we are what the economy was like in 1999.
Yeah, it's been one of my hobbies for probably going on 20 years now to kind of study the arc and the rise and fall of empire. And it's my personal opinion that we are definitely within a decline of empire here in the West, particularly in the United States. And so a lot of stuff I do in the back of my mind thinking, yes, I'm feeding some store-bought feed to the chickens, but I can also convert away from that, and I can feed them in ways where I don't have to go down to Tractor Supply. And it's you know, I still have that kind of prepper mindset, but there's, you know, if I can get a hold of like old tools, I still have, fortunately, I have quite a few of my great grandfather's tools. He was a cabinet maker and a builder. If I can get a hold of old stuff, like my wheels, my work Jeep is a 1997 Jeep Cherokee. The list of things on it that don't work is long, but it goes and it stops. I wish the gas mileage was a little bit better right now, but it does everything I need it to do. I paid for it in full, and I will literally drive it until it doesn't make sense to throw the parts at it anymore. And at, you know, we're not there yet. So, I think a lot of us might be getting close to a time where keeping up appearances maybe doesn't matter so much anymore. But, you know, taking care of yourself and making yourself a little more resilient is going to matter. So, yeah, it's kind of weird because it's still super easy to just buy stuff on Amazon. And I certainly do that. There's things that I get because I don't want to fool around at the stores or whatever. But, it's always in the back of my mind of like, do I really, really need this? Can I make something else work? And a lot of times I still do.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So let's hit a couple more, and then we'll see if there's any questions. I only have one question, guys, for Kerry Stard. So this will be your last call for questions, or even if it's just something you want us to comment on, then you can use the word comment, so the word question. If you're in the live stream, word question or comment in all caps, and then whatever you want us to talk about, and we'll try to get to you. But I'm going to throw one at Kerry. If a person is like, hey, I want to have some form of protein production in my life, probably smaller, where do you say to go with that?
I don't think you can go wrong starting with chickens. They're pretty forgiving. They serve multiple purposes, like we said earlier. You know, they'll create compost, they'll give you eggs, and when they start to age out, if you're willing to do so, you have a protein source. If you're able to keep a rooster, you can also incubate your eggs or ask somebody to do that for you, and so you've got yourself a nice little continuous system going on right there. And then perhaps my rabbit system has not been as successful as I've wanted it to be, but I've also kind of not, frankly, I just don't put the rabbits together to make more rabbits as frequently as I should. So I'm doing better on that this year. They've been beneficial to me simply for the compost and the way they convert garden weeds into really good compost materials. But, you know, rabbits are, they're quiet. You can put them in your garage if you need to. They don't even have to be outside if you don't want them to. And that quail system that I had in the city, I did a cage system, not an aviary, and it worked really well. Mm. And, you know, quail are just like constantly thinking that they're about to die, so you don't get attached to them. Every time you come up, they fly, you know, they run away, they're terrified. And you really can sit there in a chair with a bucket and process one in about a minute. So, so those three, you can stack yourself a lot of, nutrient cycling and some nutrient density.
Yeah, I would throw into that group of three, obviously, meat ducks, right? And you're going to do basically the same thing, but you got to think about water differently. Ducks turn all water into disgusting water very, very quickly. It needs to be changed daily if you're small scale. And so you need somewhere for it to go. But like one of the things we did, we made these kind of like small divergent ditches to trees. And then we just move their water every day. Now, I run too many ducks to keep doing it that way. But if you had 4 to 6 ducks, but if you're in the suburbs, ducks make noise. Mm-hmm. They make a lot of noise. But all of those work. But you know what doesn't work for that question? All of those. Pick one. Get it right. Dial it in, make it easy. And I think out of all of those, the one that will give you the greatest freedom, because you can automate so much and you can do it inside so you can leave when it's cold or when it's hot, like in a garage, is quail. Like quail in a stack system, I know some people are really opposed to it, but like that's what you did. I've done both aviary and a stack system. Are they happier in an aviary? Yes. Is it easier for the owner when they're in a stack system? Yes. Mm-hmm. So much easier. And no, you're probably not going to go away on a 2-week trip with nobody checking in on your quail, but you can damn sure easily set up a sack system where you can walk away for a long weekend and you do not have to worry when you come back. Like everything's good. Brad Davies, who I had on years ago, was running massive amount of production in a single stack out of a 1-car garage in Detroit, Michigan. So yes, very cold winters, plenty of hot summer. Everything was fine. And he even had it where like, he had automated to the point, like when he was brooding, since the incubator was automated with turning, until they hatched, he didn't care. So yeah. If he had just put eggs on and you get Friday and Monday off, and you want to break out for a 4-day weekend, he just leave. And everything, you just make sure all the hoppers were topped up, the water bucket was topped up, it was, you know, plumbed down with a little bit of tubing to drippers, and could walk away. And that's a little more difficult to pull off with the other three.
Yeah, and with a system like that, especially like you said, if it's in a garage, you can even have, you know, Wi-Fi cameras set up and actually take a look and make sure, like, is there water in the dish? And, I mean, there's just – I'm not as good at, like, the tech side of automation, but there's so much option out there for that now.
Yeah, that's very off the shelf and very easy to do now. Like, I had him on the air so long ago. Could you do a webcam and all? Yeah, but could you just buy something that you plugged in, stuck up on the wall, pointed at it, attached it to your router, and you were done? No, they didn't have that yet. And now you can do that for nothing. The cost is so low. You're going to spend more when you go to freaking fast food than for a camera to do that today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you got anything else you want to share before we take this one question? I don't know what's up with you guys. Kind of wake up out there. There's a lot of people here. Just no questions coming in by the live chat.
I do want to make people aware of a class that we're having. We are doing a humane harvest class. We're going to be harvesting 3 sheep out here. That is May 1st. We'll get started around 10 a.m. Knoxville, Tennessee. If you go to the events page at strongrootsresources.com, you can get your tickets there. I think I've already sold 5, so that leaves about 4 or 5 seats left. This is actually going to be led by a friend of mine, another regenerative farmer, Stacy Carr. She follows biblical principles for this whole process. It will not involve a firearm. So for people where the firearm is kind of a no-go for any number of reasons, this is a class worth attending. So
what is that called? Because I'm on your events page and I'm not seeing what
maybe
you're
go to Nicole told me what to look for. It might be under tickets.
Okay.
It should be under tickets then. Right. But yeah, she's got the link up there. And yeah, I'll need to add that to the class page. There we are.
There it is. Okay. I'll make sure there's a link in the show notes today for people if they want to do that. So you can, if you're anywhere near where Carrie's at, you might want to get over to Johnson City, Tennessee, and it's going to be a really cool workshop. $200, totally worth it. I'm going to say that this is like a really big thing that people need to be doing. There's people like, I'm going to get sheep and then I'm going to have meat. Okay. And then you get the sheep and then it has the baby sheep and they're all cute. And you raise the baby sheep and they like you and they nuzzle you. And then, now one day you got to make one from sheep into meat. Yep. And it's not easy for some people in some situations. You know, we did years and years ago, I did a meat run of Dixie Rainbow Chickens. And I was like, oh, I got an idea. What if people paid me to process my chickens for me? So I did put an extra day on one of my big fall classes and held them over, and they got really big, but that was great. And I did an extra class. It was $100. You come to the class, you process 2 chickens, you take one home, and I get to keep one. And then you get to learn, and you get to take a chicken home. About half the people didn't take their chickens. So that meant effectively I sold the ones I sold for $75 a chicken. That ain't bad. And it went really well, but we had 2 people that emotionally had a hard time when it came to slaughter.
Yeah.
And it's good to know that before you've saddled yourself with the responsibility for it. And I said when we started that class, if anybody gives anybody any shit whatsoever because they're having a hard time, I will put you off my property in a New York minute. Like, this is different for everybody. I also felt really bad for that one. I think as an instructor, you can be too good sometimes. And I've never done this again. So I did the first bird teaching the slaughter part, not the full processing part. And I have this thing that I do with birds when I'm processing. I don't use kill cones because I don't kill that often. I use a bucket and 2 pieces of string. I make 2 nooses. I put them on their feet. I do cut both sides of the neck, and I put them inside the bucket like it's a cone with some wood chips at the bottom that absorb the blood. And then, you know, they bleed. And then usually what happens is they bleed for a while. They don't even know it. And then they flutter a little bit, and then they die. So I did this with one chicken, and I kind of pull on their head a little bit, kind of rub their neck and palpate it. And they kind of, like, their eyes go back in their head, and they pass out. So I do the 2 cuts. I put them in the bucket, and I'm like, he'll start kicking any minute. Completely asleep. Bled out. Never flickered. And then you had, 30 people trying to replicate that. And of course I never replicated it, but there were people, because I think that first one went so smoothly when one was a girl and she, instead of getting the artery, she got the windpipe. And once you realize what's going on, you get in there and like, okay, here's what went wrong. And it choked her up pretty hard. And so yeah. I think if you're really thinking about a system that requires the death of an animal, you should go somewhere where that kind of animal is going to face that end. Because if you can't do it, it's okay. But it'd be good to know.
Yeah. Yeah, it was hard. Like, the first time I had to do the sheep. The first one I had to do was a ram that was 8-9 months old and who just decided he wasn't going to be in the fence anymore. And, yeah. You know, my weapon of choice at the time was a handgun, because the way we're laid out here with our neighbors and stuff, it's really not very safe to use any kind of long rifle. So, and the very first time I did it, it was one shot to the right location. The animal immediately went down. And then my friends who were out here to help me there, and they hunt, so they were more, you know, acclimated to, you know, dealing with things with four legs, because I'd only done birds up to that point. You know, they were like, oh, you know, good shot. And then we loaded him up and took him up to where we were breaking him down, and everything went great. And then the ones we've done since, let's just say I have not landed that first effective shot. And so, and I'm not proud of that. And it's been a point of stress for me. So when Stacy reached out to me about holding this class, I was like, you're on, let's do it. Yeah. I want other options. Yeah. So I expect it to be a really good class.
I was in one like that last year, sort of. It was a beef processing, but Sean's at Crunchy Mama's, and took my grandson there, and we did two. They were both bulls, but one was, 850-pound animal, kind of mid-sized, not really big. And when Sean shot him, he uses a hard cast 44 mag rifle, and he hit him, looked like a perfect shot, but it didn't go down, and he ended up pissed and kind of like braying and going at it, and he had to move, reposition, and pop him behind the ear, which is not what he wanted to do, because then you get into messing up some of the neck meat and the cheek meat and stuff like that and put him down. And my grandson struggled with that one. Then the next one we did was a monster. I mean, Sean has full commercial walk-ins, rollers, all of it. The quarters didn't fit in the rollers. That's how big this animal was. It was like a half Angus, half Wagyu. And, man, when he hit him, it was like an off switch. That animal never made a sound. It didn't kick. Just down and out. And I think it was good that we did two animals so people can see, like, this can go either way. Right. I think that's important for people to understand, because as a hunter, you know that, but there's a lot of people, like, the first time they do it, if they're alone, it's the first time they're doing that alone. And it's not always easy. And so I encourage that. Anyway, I'm going to make sure, folks, that Kerry's website, that class, his Instagram, his Telegram group, his Facebook group, all of it is available to you in the show notes. That's going to be on the audio only side. So if you're watching the video, then there's a link in the video notes. You can click and go over there. If you're watching us live, give it about 30 minutes after the live ends. Otherwise, if this is kind of the Memorex experience for pre-recorded, it should be there for you now. Get on over. And if it's in the future you find this video, it's episode 3826, because there'll be more of them that you can eventually get into with Kerry. Let's go ahead and take some Q&A now. Anarchy says, can swale still be used if your land is pretty flat but otherwise has clay content? Could a pond with elevated berms be used to artificially create elevation for water distribution? It depends. But go ahead, you take
that. As usual, yeah, it depends. I am still a big fan of at least micro swales when you have just a little bit of slope or undulation or whatever. They are still tremendous capturing systems. So, yes, especially with high clay content. Even more reason that, you know, if you have a high clay content, a lot of times that means that water is going to be slower to permeate into your soil. So the more you can slow that water down and sink it and give it a chance to settle and get into the soil proper, it's worth doing. That does not mean that you have to do huge, deep, you know, they can be, you know, they can be 2 feet wide and a few inches deep.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with doing it that way.
Yeah. I mean, just to reinforce, we've got some here that are 6 foot wide and several hundred feet long. And we've got some you don't even know they're swales anymore. They just look like berms. And basically the cut we made would have been like if you were pouring a sidewalk.
Yeah.
You know, 3 foot wide, couple inches deep, flat bottom. And you don't even see them until we get a heavy rainfall. And then when you go outside and you look in between the two shop buildings, they're holding a couple inches of water, and then that discharges into larger systems. So, yeah. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just want to reinforce, like, micro sometimes is the way.
It really is. Super powerful systems. Not everything has to be huge and expansive. And so, yeah, asking about a pond with elevated berms. This is something that we don't have a lot of happening yet on the farm, but it's definitely within the long-term plans, is storing more water higher in the landscape, storing that water in the soil. So, that's one of those times where, you know, depending on the size you're working with, you want to, you know, be certain of your engineering principles. You want to have options like, additional spillways. I helped a buddy with a pond project over the winter, and it was this, he did all the design and everything, and I was out there for a lot of the labor, and he created this capture system that was so simple and so elegant that, the water we were capturing was being shed off of about 4 acres, and it was coming down a ditch alongside the road. And then where there was like a really sharp, almost a 90 degree turn in the road at the corner where this pond was going in. So as the water was coming down, all really Casey did was stack and really hammer in some, sandbags to cut that water to the left onto the property, down a spillway into the pond. And so as soon as we started getting those winter rains, you know, I was calling him up. I'm like, are you down there? Are you seeing it go in? And he's like, it's working. And those same sandbags, if the pond were to become too full, and even if your auxiliary spillway is starting to discharge water back into this ditch system, he could just pull, or the homeowners could pull those sandbags and just let the water continue on the way it had.
Yep.
So super beautiful, super elegant system.
Okay. Says it's a question, but it sounds more like a statement. Amy says, if it wasn't Amy, I wouldn't read the whole thing because I would think it was off the rails, but I know it'd be all right. Question, conspiracy theory. The government is doubling down on bird flu. Does it make sense to keep quail? I have a stack in the garage as a covert squabs in case the blue hairs come for chickens and ducks.
I mean, I'd say that's smart. You know, maybe like you're doing, like, don't advertise it, but, you know, I don't believe anything that comes out of any official channels anymore, except just to have in the back of my mind, like, are they going to come bug me about X, Y, Z?
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, if you need me to put up a flag with my duck on it that says come and take it, that'll happen before I alter my life, because they might bitch because there might be bird flu. I'm not doing it. Like, I would say do the quail inside if that works for you without worrying about that. If you're doing it because of that, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't operate out of fear, guys. I mean, this whole scheme and this game the government's playing has gotten so goofy at this point. All I can do is chuckle at it. It's just, it's so absurd. Do what is going to improve your life, as we all preach around here.
Now, if I'm going to do the blue hair, hence quail thing, that's because I live in a suburban area with actual blue hairs, with an HOA or a city ordinance or something that already have a mechanism. Then I think that approach is really smart. Packrat says, what should folks in your zone be growing that you see people overlooking frequently on your consults?
I mean, I'd be amazed at how many times I just bring comfrey roots or crowns with me to a new customer. Like, just go ahead and have this. Just go ahead and just park this, even just in some pots for now. And I am also, I feel like black locust gets a lot of hate. Jack, I know you're a fan of black locust. We've got it all over this farm. My great-grandfather planted it because he was going to need fence post. Black locust is not toxic to animals unless they are in there with an excessive amount that have broken branches and become wilted. Same as like with cherry leaves. My sheep love the stuff. My donkey, if she can reach a branch, she'll strip all those leaves off. The flowers are edible, incredibly rot resistant. Every single time I need like a garden stake or, you know, some posts for a trellis or something, I just go cut a 4 to 6 inch black locust down because it's everywhere. Works great as a coppice system, just amazing stuff. And once the trees are just a few inches diameter, they're really not, they're kind of thorny on the branches, but they're not thorny on the trunk any longer. So, you know, put some gloves on and get to work. Those are my two buddies, and they're nitrogen fixers. So you can plug them in as part of a food forest system too.
Gotcha. Gotcha, man. Hey, I really appreciate you being with us today, Kerry. Again, throw out your website one more time for people that are driving or something so they can at least make that note. And again, any of the resources for Strong Root resources that you're looking for, just get over to survivalpodcast.com and look up episode 3826. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, strongrootsresources.com. Everything is there. Everything on social media, just plug in that business name. Everything's under the same umbrella there. Hop on the mailing list if you would, please. That's where I send out all the announcements for our classes and our gatherings. And my radius for consulting is about 3 to 4 hours from Knoxville, Tennessee. I consult on what I know, which is the Southeast. So, yeah, folks would like to have me out for a consult. And I'm also starting to bring content to the expert council about rotational grazing practices. So I'm going to kind of tie together my foraging knowledge and nerdiness and pair that with grazing and kind of include that as an offering as well.
Well, man, I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Please, folks, remember, Kerry is not just a guest. He is a member of the expert council. He does those segments for us about once every other week. We get a segment from Kerry, and you'll get more of them if you ask. Just send that email to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com with TSPC in the subject line. My question is for Kerry Brown. And hit return, and then give me your question. Question in one sentence, return. Now give me details. Then everybody's clear on what's going on. I'll get it over to Kerry. He'll get you an answer. Again, thank you for being with us today, man.
Glad to do it.
All right, folks, real quick before I wrap up today, I wanted to let you guys know about my item of the day. Item of the day today is the Herbal Medicine Maker's Handbook by James Green. I've said this before, and it fits Kerry as a guest today really well, but when it comes to herbs and herbal medicine, if you told me, Jack, you're going to take every book you own, and you're not going to be able to look shit up on the internet anymore. You have to use one book for all your herbal stuff. Pick one. It would be this book. How long have I loved this book? I bought my first copy of this book in the 90s. That sounds crazy to say now, but it's true. It's over 30 years I've been using this book. If you look it up, it is incredibly highly rated on Amazon. Thousands of positive reviews. I call this basically an herbology course for $20. The book is not just a resource guide. It doesn't just tell you how to do the things. It does it in a very methodical way while keeping it interesting to read. By the time you progress with this book, if you do all the little projects in it, you will be a really good backyard herbalist. I don't think you'll be out doing like consulting work for other people or anything from it. But when it comes to the way that we really need to have kind of an herbalist in every home, this is the book for that. It's a fantastic read. Again, the Herbal Medicine Maker's Handbook by James Green, a home manual. You can find it at thesurvivalpodcast.com. And you can find all of the stuff I review at tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. If you like the show and want to support our work, all you got to do is start your shopping there. Doesn't matter what you buy. Could be something I reviewed, could be something I didn't review. As long as you use the links there to initiate your shopping, you'll help us out, and I really appreciate that. Thank you to everyone who was here today. Thank you to our guest again, Kerry Brown. I will catch you guys tomorrow with an expert panel Q&A show for the week. Might even be hearing from Kerry again. I'm not sure who we have in the lineup yet, but that does mean there will not be a live stream. Expert Council shows, because of how we do them, are not live. They are Memorex, for those old enough to get the reference. And that means your next live stream will be Monday next week. And if you want to make sure you never miss a live stream, there's a lot of ways you can stay in touch with us on social media. But the most reliable thing, install the Telegram app if you don't already have it, and join the TSP broadcast channel. And that way, whenever we're going to do a show, whenever anything new happens, you'll get a little text message on your phone, and no one's going to get between you and I with that, because right now we are shadow banned in many places. We're certainly shadow banned on YouTube. We don't reach anywhere near as many people as we should, given that we have almost 70,000 subscribers here. We are definitely shadow banned on X as well, but Telegram is direct communication, so that'd be a great way to make sure you get our alerts. With that, take care, everybody. Have a great day, and I'll catch you tomorrow with that expert show. Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They say
said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.